Sure.
VOA presents the following National Geographic program as we continue to explore the world around us.
I always wondered how I was going to die, and now I know.
Meru is the culmination of all I've done, and all I've wanted to do is this peak and this climb.
Conrad's reputation among climbers is flawless.
I only go on expeditions with people that I know and that I trust.
As a team, you're the sum total of all your experience. I had heard about Renan. I knew he was strong enough.
When we got there and I looked up at the mountain, I didn't know what we were getting into.
For years and years and years, Conrad, who was my mentor, had been dreaming about this climb because his mentor, Mug Stump, had made multiple attempts on this climb as well. And so it just had this kind of aura around it, especially for me because I knew what it meant to Conrad. The thing about this film is that the intention behind it was to show a side of climbing that I didn't think that the mainstream audience really got. I think that climbing and mountain climbing is portrayed a certain way, and so I wanted to really focus on things that were important to the experience that I had as a climber. We embarked in 2008 on this climb and started shooting together. But one of the themes that we talk about in the film that I feel is really important is mentorship. You know, you don't go to school for learning how to aid climb. You're mentored and you're shown. And it's the legacy of a climber. And that's really one of the themes that we look at in the film.
Climbing with your mentors is a dangerous thing sometimes because you give them all of your trust. I gave them everything, and there was a constant battle in my mind every day. I'd be freezing, shivering uncontrollably, but I definitely didn't want to be the guy that said, oh, I'm cold, I want to go down.
Luce.
It must have been negative 20 when the sun went around the corner. It's just debilitating trying to climb in those kind of temperatures.
It's all about climbing the cracks. We don't see any here. We'd hit these totally blank sections of rock, and I was sure there wasn't anywhere else to go. But then Jimmy or Conrad would launch into the void.
You know, this is steep, modern A4 aid climbing. It's using tools. You're a craftsman, tapping and pounding and tweaking, and he's like this cabinet maker, you know, chiseling away this cabinet out of walnut or something, except, you know, if you hit that chisel one more time in your cabinet maker, maybe you split it and you ruin this cabinet. Bummer. If on an A4 pitch you like split the cabinet, you die.
We wanted to share this clip because it kind of shows this moment, this very dramatic moment where we're trying to build the tension in the film and also kind of highlight Renan's psychological state at the moment and also contrast that with where Jimmy and Conrad may be. And, you know, in terms of a narrative, like it's adding drama and dissension, this potential for dissension amongst the team and this question as to what's going to happen next.
Another aspect of climbing, of course, that we try to tackle or at least look at is risk. So much of being a climber and an alpinist is obviously risk assessment, and it's a constant assessment of your situation, constant assessment of what your exit strategies are if something goes wrong, but you're also struggling to move upwards. It's a very kind of calculated space you have to be in, and you have to constantly balance, you know, what your ego is telling you and, you know, your drive and, you know, the safety of the team. And so risk is something that, you know, Chai and I obviously talked about a lot in the making of this film. And I would get these looks while we were in the editing room, like, are you out of your mind? Which is actually one of the great challenges of making the film.
Well, risk was this, I mean, it was this constant dialogue, because what we were in this dream to have this film kind of speak to a more general audience, we had to address this idea of, are they bonkers or not? Like, are they totally crazy? Which wouldn't be true to Jimmy's vision for the film, where he really wanted to bring to light, you know, the real aspirations and dreams and mentorship and friendship that functions in this mountaineering world. And the crazy question always worked against that, because then people would write them off. They're just crazy, you know. And what seemed to be the way to address it was to bring in the families, talk, you know, illustrate the stakes, and also try to give voice to this very sophisticated decision-making that they're kind of experiencing on the mountain.
When Conrad and I first got married, he made all these promises. Oh, I'm never going to go to the big mountains again. I knew he would never quit climbing, but it wasn't long before he was dreaming of some other big expedition. And I was just rolling my eyes going, right, okay.
High-altitude Himalayan climbing is very risky. It is the most dangerous professional sport. But I think with Meru, that risk is worth it.
As an alpinist, Meru is the culmination of all I've done, and all I've wanted to do is this peak and this climb.
I am not fooled by them, and they're like, oh, I'll be safe, I'll be safe. I know that stuff can happen, you know, and that's what I always say. Yeah, yeah, but stuff can happen.
And then on the other side of this is that the climbing community and genre is quite understated. Like, if you ask them, was that difficult? They're like, it was fine. Yeah, we almost died, but it was fine. You know, it's like a very, very understated culture. And there's like, I've got some, like, I'm allowed to make fun of Jimmy for this a little bit because I'm his wife and his filmmaking partner, but it's just, it was important for me to include the next clip that we're going to show, because it was just an interesting thing that wasn't included originally, and it spoke to the understatement of the culture and how Jimmy was loath to put himself in the movie.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Xavier Delarue.
The general mood was pretty light. Our objective for the day had been reached. Good vibes. Our conversation before dropping in was go one at a time, make sure everyone's in a safe spot.
So Jeremy made a couple turns, cut up on the side of this safe zone, called me in, and I make a turn right next to his turn, and then I feel it, the whole slope shift.
I yell avalanche, just screaming, get out, get out, get out.
For a moment, it looks like slow motion. In the next moment, everything went to fast forward, and I got swept. I'm airborne, totally weightless.
And I lost sight of him. That was the last I saw at Jimmy. And the slide just kept going and going and going and going.
I just got crushed under an ocean of car-sized blocks, probably going 70, 80 miles an hour down 2,000 vertical feet.
And in my mind, I heard this voice having this conversation that was like, wow, I always wondered how I was gonna die, and now I know. I was just expecting to get torn to pieces, but after a while it started to slow down, and this weird undercurrent started pushing me up through the snow, and at the last moment I popped out of the toe of this thing, buried up to my chest. I was in that moment being like, oh my God, I'm in one piece. Like, I coughed up this huge chunk of snow and I took this huge breath and I was like, and I looked at my arms and I was like, I mean, I couldn't even believe they were still connected to my body. And then, yeah, it was a lot.
It was really difficult to descend and felt like forever, but I come around the corner and way out at the very bottom of the biggest debris fields I've ever seen is Jimmy sitting upright.
I haven't seen a fucking slide in this
This avalanche has trumped all avalanches I've ever seen. I couldn't help but think Jimmy's dead. I just can't believe that he survived it.
Oh, wow.
I just saw a miracle.
Yeah, I saw a miracle. Or I saw superhuman effort. I saw something. I don't know.
So I normally walk out of the film during that scene because it is the most difficult scene for me to watch for a few reasons. One is that we get the idea of risk comes up often around Meru, and then I'm often asked the question about, like, how do I feel about what Jimmy does? And, you know, my candid answer is I'm more nervous about our backyard in Jackson Hole where he goes out all the time and something like this happened. Than I am when he's on expedition with, you know, the best of the best, like Conrad. So that's one. That's like personally why this is difficult for me. But you know, there is no reenactment in Meru except for the actual avalanche footage here, which is shot by an avalanche expert, and it's true to the spirit, like to the facts, of the scale of the avalanche. The footage of the debris field and Jimmy afterwards is all real. And this, of course, is my, like, as a adventure shooter, I was like, how could you have had three camera crews up there and no one shot the actual avalanche? And then they very generously explained to me that, like, your chances of, you know, finding a survivor are much higher if you start making your way down as fast as possible and, like, figuring out where they may have gone, and hence, you know, they could have saved Jimmy's life, hence it doesn't exist.
The debate in the film is, you know, living life and the decisions you make, and the decisions you make about risking too much and risking too little. I don't think there's a conclusion we make from it, but I think it just hopefully draws those questions out in the audience. They're intractable decisions, kind of. You know, they are the questions of life. And hopefully that comes out in the film.
VOA, exploring the world around us.
There's a love for the country and a pride in the brand. In America's heartland, living close to the land.
Georgia is known as the Peach State, but it also leads the nation in peanut production. Peanuts can be used in everything from food products.
15 pekerja di VCD Trading ini sibuk menjahit busana eksklusif bagi wanita. Hanya sedikit perusahaan garment yang masih bisa bertahan di kota New York akibat murahnya tenaga kerja di Asia, terutama Tiongkok. Dan kini ada undang-undang yang mengatur kenaikan upah minimum menjadi $15 per jam di kota New York, sehingga semakin mempersulit usaha kecil. Steve Hang adalah imigran dari Tiongkok yang datang melalui Vietnam. Ia adalah satu di antara 70.000 pengusaha kecil di kota New York. Sekitar 52% pemilik usaha kecil di kota ini adalah kaum imigran. Kliennya termasuk merek ternama kelas atas seperti The Row yang dimiliki mantan bintang cilik Ashley dan Mary-Kate Olsen. Menurut Steve, pemerintah Amerika bisa membantunya bersaing melawan pabrik garment dari Tiongkok.
If the government can make importing goods a little bit more expensive where the cost is not that big of a difference, then maybe that would help us out. If you're going to bring something in from another country and the duty on it was suffice that it's not as cheap as you think, then maybe made in the USA will get a big kick.
Susie Leibowitz dari perusahaan pakaian olahraga di New York menghargai adanya pabrik milik Steve.
It just ends up being cheaper, faster, easier because you can communicate directly with the factory. You can just walk over if there's an issue and solve it. Made in the USA. It's a big selling point. And it's a really big selling point selling to international customers, oddly enough.
Di New York dan kota Amerika lainnya, usaha milik imigran memberi warna tersendiri pada lingkungan kota. Umumnya ini terjadi di distrik bisnis menurut periset imigran David Kalik.
The areas, the restaurants, the grocery stores, the hair salons, the dry cleaners, the stuff that makes up the kind of the character of a neighborhood. And there we see that, so if in the country, around the country, there 18% of all businesses are owned by immigrants, 28% of all Main Street businesses are owned by immigrants. So they're playing a big role there.
Ada sekitar 4,9 juta usaha kecil di Amerika Serikat, tapi yang mampu bertahan hidup tidaklah banyak. Data menunjukkan hanya 50% usaha kecil di Amerika yang bisa bertahan 5 tahun atau lebih, sementara hanya 30% yang bisa tetap membuka usahanya hingga 10 tahun lebih. Dari Washington, saya Helmy Yohannes dan tim VOA. Kini kita kembali ke Metro TV Jakarta. Cek, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Data menunjukkan hanya 50% usaha kecil di Amerika yang bisa bertahan 5 tahun atau lebih. Sementara hanya sekitar 30% bisa tetap usahanya hingga 10 tahun lebih. Dari Washington, saya Helmy Yohannes dan tim VOA. Cek. Buka usahanya hingga 10 tahun lebih. Dari Washington, saya Helmy Yohannes dan tim VOA. Kini kita kembali ke Metro TV Jakarta. Is that good? Okay. Data menunjukkan hanya 5. Lima belas pekerja di VCD Trading ini sibuk menjahit busana eksklusif bagi wanita. Hanya sedikit perusahaan garmen yang masih bisa bertahan di kota New York akibat musim. 15 pekerja divisi di Trading ini sibuk menjahit busana eksklusif bagi wanita. Hanya bertahan di kota New York. Hanya sedikit perusahaan garmen yang masih bisa bertahan di kota New York akibat murahnya tenaga kerja di Asia, terutama Tiongkok. Dan kini ada undang-undang yang mengatur kenaikan upah minimum menjadi $15 per jam di kota New York, sehingga semakin mempersulit usaha kecil. Steve Hang adalah imigran dari Tiongkok yang datang melalui Vietnam. Ia adalah satu di antara 70.000 pengusaha kecil di kota New York. Sekitar 52% pemilik usaha kecil di kota ini adalah kaum imigran. Kliennya termasuk merek ternama kelas atas seperti The Row yang dimiliki mantan bintang cilik Ashley dan Mary-Kate Olsen. Menurut Steve, pemerintah Amerika bisa membantunya bersaing melawan pabrik garment dari Tiongkok.
If the government can make importing goods a little bit more expensive where the cost is not that big of a difference, then maybe that would help us out. If you're going to bring something in from another country and the duty on it was suffice that it's not as cheap as you think, then maybe made in the USA will get a big kick.
Susie Leibowitz dari perusahaan pakaian olahraga di New York menghargai adanya pabrik milik Steve.
It just ends up being cheaper, faster, easier because you can communicate directly with the factory. You can just walk over if there's an issue and solve it. Made in the USA. It's a big selling point. And it's a really big selling point selling to international customers, oddly enough.
Di New York dan kota Amerika lainnya, usaha milik imigran memberi warna tersendiri pada lingkungan kota. Umumnya ini terjadi di distrik bisnis, menurut periset imigran David Kalik.
There is the restaurants, the grocery stores, the hair salons, the dry cleaners, the stuff that makes up the kind of the character of a neighborhood. And there we see that. So if in the country, around the country, there 18% of all businesses are owned by immigrants. 28% of all Main Street businesses are owned by immigrants. So they're playing a big role there.
Ada sekitar 4,9 juta usaha kecil di Amerika Serikat, tapi yang mampu bertahan hidup tidaklah banyak. Data menunjukkan hanya 50% usaha kecil di Amerika yang bisa bertahan 5 tahun atau lebih, sementara hanya sekitar 30% bisa tetap membuka usahanya hingga 10 tahun lebih. Dari Washington, saya Helmy Yohanes dan tim VOA. Kini kita kembali ke Metro TV Jakarta. Lima belas pekerja divisi di Trading ini sibuk menjahit busana eksklusif bagi wanita. Hanya sedikit perusahaan garmen yang masih bisa bertahan di kota New York akibat murahnya tenaga kerja di Asia, terutama Tiongkok. Dan kini ada undang-undang yang mengatur kenaikan upah minimum menjadi $15 per jam di kota New York, sehingga semakin mempersulit usaha kecil. Steve Hang adalah imigran dari Tiongkok yang datang melalui Vietnam. Ia adalah satu di antara 70.000 pengusaha kecil di kota New York. Sekitar 52% pemilik usaha kecil di kota ini adalah kaum imigran. Kliennya termasuk merek ternama kelas atas seperti The Row yang dimiliki mantan bintang cilik Ashley dan Mary-Kate Olsen. Menurut Steve, pemerintah Amerika bisa membantunya bersaing melawan pabrik garment dari Tiongkok.
If the government can make importing goods a little bit more expensive where the cost is not that big of a difference, then maybe that would help us out. If you're going to bring something in from another country and the duty on it was suffice that it's not as cheap as you think, then maybe made in the USA will get a big kick.
Susie Leibowitz dari perusahaan pakaian olahraga di New York menghargai adanya pabrik milik Steve.
It just ends up being cheaper, faster, easier because you can communicate directly with the factory. You can just walk over if there's an issue and solve it. Made in the USA. It's a big selling point. And it's a really big selling point selling to international customers, oddly enough.
Di New York dan kota Amerika lainnya, usaha milik imigran memberi warna tersendiri pada lingkungan kota. Umumnya ini terjadi di distrik bisnis menurut periset imigran David Kalik.
The areas, the restaurants, the grocery stores, the hair salons, the dry cleaners, the stuff that makes up the kind of the character of a neighborhood. And there we see that, so if in the country, around the country, there are 18% of all businesses are owned by immigrants. 28% of all Main Street businesses are owned by immigrants. So they're playing a big role there.
Ada sekitar 4,9 juta usaha kecil di Amerika Serikat, tapi yang mampu bertahan hidup tidaklah banyak.
Data menunjukkan hanya sekitar 50% usaha kecil di Amerika yang bisa bertahan 5 tahun atau lebih, sementara hanya sekitar 30% bisa tetap membuka usahanya hingga 10 tahun lebih. Dari Washington, saya Helmy Yohannes dan tim VOA. Kini kita kembali ke Metro TV Jakarta.
Di Hanover, Presiden Obama melimpahkan pujian bagi Kanselir Jerman Angela Merkel yang disebut sebagai bukan hanya sekutu namun juga teman.
This is as important a relationship as I've had during the course of my presidency. Chancellor Merkel has been consistent, she has been steady, she is trustworthy.
Agenda resmi Presiden Obama adalah menerima undangan Kanselir Merkel membuka Hanover Messe, pameran industri teknologi terbesar dunia. Namun kunjungan ini juga untuk memberi dukungan politik bagi Kanselir Merkel yang popularitasnya turun akibat kebijakannya menampung pengungsi Suriah. Namun kedatangan Presiden Obama disambut unjuk rasa 35 ribu warga Jerman yang menolak TTIP. Kemitraan perdagangan dan investasi antara Amerika Serikat dan Uni Eropa ini dinilai akan menekan upah buruh, mengikis perlindungan konsumen dan lingkungan hidup.
Grundsätzlich immer schon engagiert gegen diese Abkommen, die im Endeffekt eigentlich eine Enteignung, eine demokratische darstellen.
Sebelum tiba di Jerman, Presiden Obama berada di London, di mana ia membuat marah aktivis Brexit, gerakan yang ingin Inggris keluar dari Uni Eropa.
The UK would not be able to negotiate something with the United States faster.
Isu persatuan Eropa akan menjadi sorotan pertemuan Presiden Obama dengan pemimpin Jerman, Inggris, Prancis, dan Italia di Jerman awal minggu ini. Retaknya persatuan Eropa dinilai sebagai satu lagi hambatan bagi Washington untuk memperlakukan strategi pivot to Asia, yaitu politik luar negeri yang lebih fokus ke Asia. Sebagaimana tampak dari lawatan ke Riyadh, London, dan Jerman minggu ini, sulit bagi Presiden Obama untuk berpaling dari Timur Tengah dan Eropa. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA. Di Hanover, Presiden Obama melimpahkan pujian bagi Kanselir Jerman Angela Merkel yang disebut sebagai bukan hanya sekutu namun juga teman.
This is as important a relationship as I've had during the course of my presidency. Chancellor Merkel has been consistent, she has been steady, she is trustworthy.
Agenda resmi Presiden Obama adalah menerima undangan Kanselir Merkel membuka Hanover Messe, pameran industri teknologi terbesar dunia. Namun kunjungan ini juga untuk memberi dukungan politik bagi Kanselir Merkel yang popularitasnya turun akibat kebijakannya menampung pengungsi Suriah. Namun kedatangan Presiden Obama disambut unjuk rasa 35 ribu warga Jerman yang menolak TTIP. Kemitraan perdagangan dan investasi antara Amerika Serikat dan Uni Eropa ini dinilai akan menekan upah buruh, mengikis perlindungan konsumen dan lingkungan hidup.
Grundsätzlich immer schon engagiert gegen diese Abkommen, die im Endeffekt eigentlich eine Enteignung, eine demokratische darstellen.
Sebelum tiba di Jerman, Presiden Obama berada di London, di mana ia membuat marah aktivis Brexit, gerakan yang ingin